You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 242 is Marshall Crenshaw. This singer-songwriter burst onto the major label scene with his self-titled 1982 album. You're right now hearing Someday, Someway, one of the big singles from that. He was frequently compared to Buddy Holly, and in fact played Buddy Holly in the 1987 film La Bamba, and appeared in the on-screen band for the film Peggy Sue Got Married. I should say he's also done some co-songwriting work, most notably with the Gin Blossoms, their song Till I Hear It From You, giant hit Marshall co-wrote. He recorded 5 total albums on Capitol Records through the 80s, and 1 more album on a different major label, and has since been an indie artist. He's got 10 albums total, plus some live collections and a presentation of his early demos. His 10th album actually collects together and fixes up, reissues some of his EPs. It's called From the Hellhole, and we'll be discussing the song Stranger and Stranger, originally released on the 2012 Stranger and Stranger EP, but you can't even find that version anymore. This is the new definitive version, and we'll talk about Right on Time from his last full album, 2009's Jagged Land. Then look all the way back to Life's Too Short from 1991. That was the album from MCA. The song is A Fantastic Planet of Love. We'll conclude by going back all the way to his second album, Field Day, 1983, and listen to the wonderful song, Our Town. Learn more at marshallcrenshaw.com. Learn about this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Support this podcast at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will play a little bit of Someday, Someway from your self-titled 1982 album. We want to get pretty quickly to the newest thing, From the Hellhole 2025. I thought this was the new thing, but I see actually it's Stranger and Stranger from the Stranger and Stranger EP 2013. So there's been a gap there where you've just had some live albums and some reissues. Yeah, do we want to give them like a little sense of the shape of your career? You had a bunch of early 80s stuff and then it petered off a little bit, and you've been playing live very continuously, right? Yeah, so what's the story with the latest batch?
Yeah, I've been doing everything continuously over the years.
Okay.
But I guess there was like a 6-year gap between albums at one point, which was the longest gap. But anyway, Stranger and Stranger, yeah, it initially came out in 2012 on an EP. I was doing a series of EPs at the time. The version that's on the new album is a kind of a reworked version of the song. You know, like I did a lot of editing on the recording and just kind of fixed all the things about the original recording that bothered me. I chopped big pieces out of it. I mean, it's the same, but it's different, you know.
Sad to say, I'm confronted by this fact. She's gone away now and never will be back. It's so true that time can be a cruel rearranger. And the weather outside is getting stranger and stranger. Seems like everything's shifting in many crazy ways. I thought that I'd have her beside me all my days. Something unforeseen came along and it changed her. Have been stranger and stranger.
Too much.
So I watched a number of live versions of this, which it seemed like you switch keys. The whole, is it a marimba, a xylophone? That's a prominent in this.
It's a vibraphone played by a really great musician, a guy named Brian Carrot. Just a super nice guy. I love what he did on the track.
And so it seems like you're kind of covering that with your own guitar when you're playing it live, because it's sort of giving you the foundation of the changing between the chords. Did you write this on acoustic and you're sort of, that part is present on acoustic on this recording, but it's sort of low? Or did you have to kind of come up with something? Okay, now I'm going to play this live. I got to rework this.
Gosh, I don't remember writing it, honestly. Okay. Like, I have the work tape, let's call it, even though it's in Pro Tools. But I knew I was doing the EPs, and so therefore I was motivated to write songs. That's how it always works with me, is I write songs when I have a recording project. And if I don't, then I don't write anything. But I don't have any real clear memories of actually writing it or what I was thinking about when I wrote the music. I think I was just letting it kind of flow out. I figured out what the beat was going to be and then just kind of built it up from there. That's what I always do.
Everything is playable just by you solo before you go in and have this whole vibraphone and everything. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, I just had to figure out how to play it. Mm-hmm. The record is one thing. And when that's all done, then it's set in stone, so to speak. And, you know, but then when you play the song live, it's different every time you play it.
Do you remember, other than the vibraphone player, was this your live band at the time? Is that how you normally work? Or do you kind of form a live band whenever you're going to go on tour versus the recording, as you say, is a different thing?
Let me see. On the record, I'm on drums.
Okay.
I did the drums first because, you know, you got to do the drums first, right? At least I do. And then I guess I just put a guitar on it, probably the one that's on the record. And then a fella from the neighborhood named Manuel Quintana came over and brought some congas with him. And then he played my bongos, you know, so he just kind of put some nice percussion on it. The bass player is a guy named Byron House. And he did his part at home down in Nashville. And it's just a guy that I've known for a long time. And at one point he said to me, hey, if you ever need anything from me, la, la, la. So I thought I'd get Byron to play on this track. And then, like I said before, Brian Carrot is on vibraphone. When I played this song live, and when it was new, I was touring with a group called the Bottle Rockets. You know, you ever hear of it?
Yeah.
I just sent it to them and they learned it. And that was it. We just played it. We never rehearsed or anything or talked that much about what we were going to do or how we were going to play it. We would just play it maybe once at soundcheck and then play it on stage.
So this version, you're doing all the guitar solos, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's, let me see. There's electric rhythm that goes through the whole thing. And then there's another sort of like foundational part that's on a Dan Electro six string bass, but I'm playing it like a guitar.
Oh, okay.
And then when I did this redone version, I put an acoustic on it in a couple spots.
I was wondering if that was the foundation, but no, it was the last thing added. Interesting.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's mostly me, except for the people I just named, Manuel, Brian, Byron. Everything else is me.
So it seems like you're not so precious about your guitar solos. I saw a couple times, yeah, these other live versions. There was one live on the radio where it's just you and one other guitarist and you do the first solo and then you pass it to him. Like, well, you have got two lead players there. You might as well use that, as opposed to, well, this is what I did on the record, so I'm just going to do this and you support me.
That's another thing I did when I did this kind of reworked version for the that's on the album. I was really disturbed by my guitar solo as it was on the EP. Ah. I just thought it was like one of those really overkill kind of solos, like too much caffeine, too many notes.
Given how relaxed a song it is, yeah.
My big thing now is like subtraction. You know, when I'm like going back and re-listening to something I've done, usually I want to remove about like as much of it as I can, take out the excessive moments of it. So I fixed the guitar solo and made it better. So that's the music. And then like the lyrics, it's a dark song, even though, I mean, it's in a major key. So the piece of music is in a major key. So you might not right away understand that it's a dark song, but it is, you know, like the first thing I was writing about was the death of a friend of mine. Stranger and Stranger is just about, you know, how there are all these things in the air that maybe weren't there before, you know. It's just like that time period when I was writing it. It's just like, what's the world like now? What world are we living in now? And so I was writing about this friend of mine who died, and I was trying to figure out, well, gosh, you know, what happened to her? Was it something that she ate, or something that she breathed, or something that she drank, something in the environment that got her? Because she wasn't like a person with toxic habits necessarily.
Sure.
So that was one thing. And then my dad was dying at the time, too. So there's just this kind of somberness to the whole thing. And then the day that we did the vibraphone, the day that Brian came in and played, happened to be the day of the Sandy Hook school shooting.
Oh, jeez.
So I was leaving the studio, and there was a TV set like in the lobby of the studio that I just kind of glanced at as I was walking out. And I saw what it was, and I'm like, what a day this is, you know, just horrifying. I'm still horrified at the thought of it.
Well, that's a pretty heavy euphemism. Something unforeseen came along and it changed her. I mean, that, yes, that's the ultimate change, but that's certainly not on first read what I thought that meant. It just, oh, her heart was hardened. She left me. I thought this was a love song.
No, it's not a breakup song. It's like when I say she'll never be back. I mean that she never will be back. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess I don't come right out and yell these things. They're maybe a little subtle, but the Sandy Hook school shooting. And then later that same day, I got a call from my brother, Robert. My phone rang and I saw that it was him, and I didn't even pick up the phone because I knew he was calling to tell me that our dad had died. So like, there's just all this stuff. Hurricane Sandy happened during the time I was writing the song, like Hoboken, New Jersey got turned into a swimming pool. So it's just a little bit of all of that, stranger and stranger.
In redoing this, you were strictly fixing things about the mix and the arrangement. You weren't like rewriting any parts of it. Like, I don't like that one line, because you didn't redo the vocals.
No, the song stayed the same. I just tampered with the execution of it, the performance a little bit. And then not even a whole lot, but just somewhat, you know.
Let me insert the beginning of the guitar solo. And when you start, there's not even drums playing. You sort of were starting just guitar. So was that part of the redo, that you were going to have this sort of little breakdown for when the guitar comes in?
No, the drums are the same. I didn't touch the drums, I don't think.
So it wasn't even like remixing anything. Okay.
And I didn't do the final mix either. That was another thing I had to correct, because on the EP version, I did mix it. And that was a mistake. Anytime I try to mix something myself, I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing. So I got, you know, somebody, but before I sent it to him, I edited everything the way I wanted it to be.
So what was the motivation to do this from the hellhole? I'm going to rework. Are the other songs on here also similarly reworked, or are they more just a gathering of past releases or?
Some of them aren't. Some of them are untouched from the way they originally came out. But it was just a matter of getting them to where they suited my taste right now.
Sure.
With the EP series, there were like built-in deadlines with it. I would have to have something ready. The way it worked was they came out on Record Store Day, which was twice a year. So there'd be two EPs per year, and that ran for 3 years. And there were six altogether. I liked the built-in deadlines, but, you know, stepping back later on and listening, and I'm like, well, that should be better than it is. So, you know, I would fix stuff.
So do you know, as far as like the bass goes, you said he did that remotely. Was there any sort of back and forth, or is just whatever you do, I trust you, I've worked with you before, okay, that sounds great. You know, is that sort of the level? You seem pretty particular about many of the parts. So were you as particular?
I am very particular, you know, and actually with a bass player, like all the different bass players that play on this album, what I ask of them is I say, give me three good takes.
Oh, okay.
You know, they don't all have to be identical, but, you know, just give me three good takes. And then I'm like merciless, you know, like I chop and slice and dice. If somebody plays a wrong note, then I'll find the right note and put it where it belongs. If somebody plays a lick where it should be like a sustained note,
Just grab it from the next measure. Yeah.
Yeah, I can take one note and lengthen it and make it sound like the bass player just played the note and let it ring. I can do all that stuff. I'm a pretty good audio editor. So, you know, that's what I would say, I guess, to everybody that played an overdub for me. I just say, give me three good takes and let me chop it up.
Well, that explains why you know, the appeal of wanting to be the mixer, that even if you're not the mixer who's determining the final levels of everything and what effects exactly are getting added to the kick and stuff like that, you at least want to line everything up and do the arrangements part of the mix.
Yeah.
And then let somebody else worry about the sort of mastering the final steps of actually making everything sound great in a variety of speaker environments.
Yeah, I don't have that skill that some people have where they can really create a like a sonic thing that is a mix. You know, I just can't really do that. But I can, you know, I guess what I do is like pre-mixing.
Sure.
Yeah.
So when you were doing the mix, would you still have somebody else master it? They can sort of fix the overall low end level and stuff like that. Like, that's the stuff I just don't have the equipment to do accurately. Like, I definitely want somebody else to do that. I could add reverb. I know, you know, it's not that hard.
If it's something that I know I can do well and that I want to do, then I want to do it. But if it's something that I know I can't do, I want somebody great to do it for me. You know?
Sure. So like the guitar sound that you have on the solo, which is sort of reverb drenched, I assume that you're not letting the mixing guy decide. I mean, they could add X reverb, but you know, you're giving them, this is the sound. So that part is already mixed, essentially.
That's right, yeah.
I need to take time out here to read some ads. And first, we've got one from a new sponsor, Rula. Obviously, this podcast is all about self-examination, and therapy is the way you can do that to your own benefit. But a lot of the reason that I've used, say, podcasts to explore my own emotions is because therapy is expensive. Well, Rula's mission is to make high-quality mental health care from a licensed professional easy and affordable to everyone. They take most major insurance plans, which means that the average copay is only $15 per session. I have used internet-based therapy before. I had never wanted to actually go drive to someone's office and spend too much of the day dealing with that. Rula partners with a network of over 15,000 therapists and psychiatrists nationwide. So if you go to their site, they're going to start by asking a few questions about what's important to you, and they'll provide a list of in-network providers who match your preferences. You can schedule your preferred time and meet with your therapist as soon as the next day. And Rula is not just a broker and scheduling platform. They're going to help you throughout your therapy journey. They're going to monitor the quality of your patient's care. They're going to help with medication management if that's necessary. So stop putting off getting the help you need, or that would just be helpful. Thousands have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. Head on over to rula.com/NEM to get started today. After you sign up, they ask you where you heard about them, so please support our show and tell them our show sent you. Go to rula.com/NEM and take the first step towards better mental health today. You deserve quality care from someone who cares. But you don't want to just protect your mental health. You want to protect your online health, your online security with a virtual private network, a VPN. Surfshark is the one that I'm telling you about, which I have had very good experiences with. First, what is a VPN? It is a program that encrypts your internet activity. It hides your location from the sites you visit. And those two things are vital. First, if you are on the internet using public Wi-Fi, maybe at your school, at a cafe, at a hotel, you are in significant danger of having your data stolen. And even if you're in your home, perhaps you've used an incognito window, as they call them on Chrome, or private browsing. When you open such a window, it will tell you that the sites you're visiting know who you are. Is that always something that you want? Perhaps your state government wants to hide information from people in your location. Well, if you use a VPN, then the site doesn't know your location, so it doesn't block it. If, for instance, you are watching Netflix on your computer, the content you'll see will be determined by where Netflix thinks you physically reside. So go tell it that you are in the UK, that you're in Australia, that you're in France, and you'll get a whole different set of options. Now, Surfshark in particular is ridiculously easy to use. They have over 3,000 servers in 100 countries. You can run it on unlimited devices, and you can use it in conjunction with other Surfshark products like Surfshark Antivirus and a Surfshark search engine that does not track any of your searches. Try out Surfshark risk-free with their 30-day money-back guarantee. Secure your privacy with Surfshark. Go to surfshark.com/nakedly for 4 extra months of Surfshark. And if you forget that URL, just look in the show notes.
Well, let's get a second song out there. Right on Time from Jagged Land, I had picked. I really enjoyed this one. It's got sort of a, what is this? Is it spaghetti Western, Mexican? What the do? I'm not sure what kind of beat that is. Yeah, any thoughts about where you were at back in 2009 recording this before we hear it?
Yeah, Jagged Land, that's an album where I really worked hard on all the songs and like maybe overthought some of them. That's what I have come to believe, you know. Anyway, we cut the tracks for it. The album has 11 tracks or maybe 12. I guess 8 of them was this kind of band that Greg Lease helped put together. Greg Lease is a studio musician out in Los Angeles and has played on thousands of records. And I've known him for a long time, and he's a super great guy. And I told him I was going to come out there and record, and that I was interested in using a stand-up bass and a vibraphone player. And I also wanted to work with Jim Keltner, and I knew that he knew Jim. So Greg helped me get the band together. He suggested Sebastian Steinberg as the bass player, and Sebastian is brilliant. And then the vibraphone player was a guy named Emil what? Not Emil Jannings. That's somebody else. I can't remember his name, and he's a really famous guy. He played with Frank Sinatra.
Emil Richards?
Emil Richards. That was the band, and we just set up in a circle. They'd listen to the demos I brought, and then we'd just cut the track and all play together. And that was really cool. You know, no editing.
I had a strange dream one time. There was you, Bobby Vinton, and me in a hotel ballroom full of marble and mahogany. Somebody shouted, "Let the joy begin," and everyone and everything was rocking there and then. But there were holes in the ballroom floor leading straight into the blue sky. I took the wrong step, and just like that, I was falling downward in a tailspin. I woke up then, and just in time, I see a beautiful bluebird on my windowsill, and a one-eyed black cat moving in for the kill. And then I see you pull up in the drive. That's enough to make me more than glad to be alive. You're always there when you say you'll be, and I know I always will remember last December. For some reason or for a few, through a dark void I was calling when you came calling, and right on time. Yeah, you came along right on time. Lonesome was my middle name, and then right on time, but you came and changed the game. You wrapped your sweet love around me, but put my feet back on the ground. You talked me down, me around, right on time, right on
middle name, and then
Yeah, so we got a thick moving guitar on the right side, and then this one that's occasionally doing sort of slidey licks in the left side, in addition to what's obviously your main guitar that's holding things down. Was this you overdubbing yourself? Do you remember? I mean, I know it's been a while.
Greg Lees is just a fantastic player, whatever he played, you know, and he plays pedal steel, he plays lap steel, he plays six-string Spanish guitar and electric guitar. Whatever he plays, it's great, you know. So I don't know what he, like I said, I haven't heard that track since we did it. That little snippet that you just played, I thought, it's too fast. The tempo's too fast.
Okay.
And sure enough, I could hear myself, you know, fighting to get the words out at that tempo. I bet probably at the time I didn't think it was, but I do now. Like I hear, anyway.
It's at least starts off describing a dream. So it seems like it should not be a really high energy dream. You know, make it float a little, because when you go into the chorus, there were holes in the ballroom floor leading straight into the blue sky. Like it opens up. It's pretty.
Yeah.
Although you're actually describing the more horrible thing. Like the beginning where it sounded sinister, it's just, oh, everybody's rocking. Like, okay. And then the floor drops out and now it's a beautiful flying song. So it's an interesting contrast there.
Yeah, those are crazy words.
And only the beginning is the dream. The rest is just like a good relationship song. Thanks for being there for me. I've been depressed and you've been there for me, and that's great. Do you even recall at this point how that, okay, we're going to have this dream at the beginning, but then the rest of it is not a dream, but we're not going to change. It's not like we're going to change the music to make it not dreamlike or you know, anything like that. It's just going to keep going.
Yeah, I had the music first, and then, you know, I was writing the words, and it was one of those deals where I got an idea, and I thought, oh, is that too stupid to put this song? I'm talking about Bobby Vinton and all that stuff, but you know what? It was a real dream that I had. I remember that now. The guy who was my booking agent at the time is a longtime close friend of mine, and I need to go see this guy because he moved to Florida. And I told him that when he moved, I would come and visit him. And I still haven't done it. And it's been about 10 years now. But anyway, it was a real dream. I had a dream where I was with that friend of mine at this like event somewhere. And Bobby Vinton was there, too. So I just went ahead and put the real dream in the song, even though I thought mentioning Bobby Vinton in a song is pretty oddball. But I don't know. Maybe somebody will laugh.
The actual dream included then, and now we're falling through the floor.
Yeah, I think so. You know, like at some point, I guess I ran out of dream and then just had to kind of invent the rest so it would fit the verse, the length of the verse. But no, that was a real dream I had at some kind of show business event with my friend. His name's Jeffrey Osborne. Me and Jeffrey and Bobby Vinton were hanging around in a ballroom. That was really in the dream.
Well, and structurally, I really like songs. I write more and more songs now. They get to be 5 or 6 minutes because you have basically two choruses. I mean, you could call it the pre-chorus or whatever, but the first time, there are holes in the ballroom floor. Like, this sounds like it's opening up to the chorus, and then you go right back to the verse. But clearly, the right on time part, like, that's the actual chorus.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you think of that as, like, chorus two? Or, oh, that's the chorus, and the other is the pre-chorus? How do you even think of this when you're writing a lead sheet or something?
I don't think about it. I try not to think. I try to just let it occur, you know. That's my answer to that.
I don't mean that like you're programming a structure and that this, there's anything artificial about this. Of course, it's very natural. But just in trying to, I had a song like this and it was like, you really don't want the actual chorus to come until 2 minutes in? Like that's the catchy part. Don't you want the catchy part to be earlier? I don't know. That was a piece of feedback I got about a song like that. But I don't know. I like stuffing different sections in it.
Yeah.
But then you don't actually have a bridge, right? So the chorus two sort of serves as the bridge. It's got that extra long tail to it.
Again, I don't remember this one all that well.
You don't play this live?
We did for a while, I think. I imagined that I did probably right when I first got together with the Bottle Rockets, which was in 2011. Jagged Land was about a year old, and it was all the most recent stuff that I had. So I think we played this one for a minute. I know we played this one. There's another one on the album that Richard Julian helped me with. Oh, Stormy River. I know we played that one for a while with the Bottle Rockets. I did. But anyway, the song Right on Time, it just came out the way it came out.
Let me play a little bit again of the guitar solo. So I guess this is you. I had some notes that Wayne Kramer and Jason Krigler played on this album. I don't know, it was this song.
Yeah, that's me. I had one Stratocaster at the sessions where it was me and Jim Keltner and Greg and the other guys, and we just mostly did it live in real time. I had one Stratocaster and a Vox amplifier. That's how I know that was me.
I was kind of surprised when I finally heard, I think it was well into the song, when I heard, there is a little marimba in here, because it's very, you got so much guitar action that it's pretty low.
Yeah, he didn't really do very much, honestly. You know, like, I don't think he played any solos on anything.
Hmm.
And he would just kind of do like rudimentary pads, you know, and just play chords. And then if he did a tambourine part, he would say, I'll just play it all the way through and then you can pop it in and out later on. You know, it was just like very efficient about everything that he did.
Sure.
He had great stories, though. Whenever we weren't recording, just sitting around taking a break, you know, he was the only musician I've ever worked with who had Frank Sinatra stories.
Okay.
You know, from having worked with and toured all over the world with Sinatra, you know, and I'm like, oh, this is good.
Okay. So this was not a young guy. This is Emil Richards.
Oh, no. Let me see. I think he's made his first records with a musician named George Shearing. Have you ever heard of George Shearing?
No.
He's a famous jazz musician. Anyway, Emil Richards was...
Born 1932.
Him and Jim Keltner knew each other really well, though. They played together on a lot of different things. Oh, Jim had a great story, too, but he wasn't telling the story to me. I just was standing near him, and I think he was telling Emil about it. He says, oh, yeah, last night I went out to see the L.A. Philharmonic, and I took Charlie Watts with me because I wanted him to see this young percussionist in the orchestra that I think is really great. And I thought that was an interesting story to hear about Jim Keltner taking Charlie Watts to see the L.A. Philharmonic so they could eyeball this young percussionist in the orchestra. Jagged Land, I really loved the album when I did it, and it was really fun to make. And I thought it was great when I finished it.
You know, we haven't talked yet about your philosophy of harmony vocals. Like, it seems, unlike the third song that we're going to get to soon, in these two songs, they're pretty minimal. You got some vocal doubling of yourself to just thicken things. There are holes in the ballroom floor. Like, okay, so we're doing that. But otherwise, it's just like the Right on Time. But it's not like you're layering them to high. It's sort of as minimal. It seems like you're being a little minimalist here. Is that in general are the harmonies in your head? Is it the producer? How does it generally work?
You know, like, that's good. If I did it that way, it's like, you know, do the least that you have to do, not the most. I'm not, you know, I don't want to just cram information in anymore. I don't like that approach. Keep it spare. Keep it minimal. Less is more. Subtract rather than pile on. That's sort of how I go now, you know.
And you do have in both these songs either an oohs or ahs, which, you know, having one person do an ooh is a little lame. So, you know, you got a little bit of stack in there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you wrapped your sweet love around me. I don't know, the combined effect of using this and the vibraphone, do you just not
like keyboards. You don't want keyboard pads in anything at this point.
That's a thing for sure. But I mean, I don't have a issue with keyboards, but I love the vibraphone. I just absolutely love that instrument.
Sure.
I got one at one point in time, and this was about 15 years ago. I bought this vibraphone, and it was this brand, a Japanese brand called a Kost or something like that. K-O-T-S-C-H. I forget how it's spelled, but it's like the least highly regarded brand of vibraphone.
Okay.
Like real vibraphone players don't play this brand, you know. And it was really kind of flimsy, but, you know, it was a vibraphone and it was in tune. And I said, all right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get a teacher and I'm going to take lessons. And I never did it. I just had the vibraphone for about 10 years. And I would noodle around on it. There are a couple tracks on the Hellhole album where I play the vibraphone, you know, like there's,
yep.
I played some vibraphone on the cover that I did of the Carpenters, Close to You, just simple little parts like that. I never really got good on the vibraphone, but I wish I could play one. I love the sound. I love to listen to, you know, Bobby Hutcherson and Milt Jackson and, you know, people that really play the thing. So, yeah, I've had like three of my albums where I've had a vibraphone player.
Well, and you're clearly a very good guitarist and got away with doing drums on Stranger and Stranger, which it's not like I heard that and then heard the next one and thought, oh, Jim Kelly, this is so much better than what was on the other. You're clearly a perfectly competent drummer. And if you can play bass, you play guitar. I mean, have you like one man band your various demos and things over the years, or is there an album that...
I love to do it. Yeah, I can do that. I can make a whole record all by myself. As far as the drums go, I'd say I was a wannabe drummer, but, you know, I can think like a drummer and I can hear like a drummer. It's just the physical chops, you know, that you need. That I don't have that. I don't have the facility that a real drummer has, somebody who plays drums all the time, all their life. I wish I did, but I played all the tracks on the Hellhole album. I did the drums on those. All the tracks on an album of mine called Number 447, I did that. Once I got to where I could play it all, I just wanted to start playing on my records because I just love to do it. It's really fun. Sometimes I have to do, you know, like a day's worth of takes and then do a bunch of magic tricks to make it work. But
sure,
you know, sometimes I want to interpret the song myself just because I have a really strong sense of how it should be interpreted. And so I do it, you know, I just make it work.
We talked about your receiving things over the internet. When you're working in a room with a drummer, especially someone like Jim Keltner, I would think there wouldn't be a lot of, oh, could you do a, can you?
No, I didn't say a thing to him. I didn't say a word to him. And it was interesting that way because I got results, better results than if I had asked him to do this or that. Just him being himself, you know, was better than whatever I was going to try to put in his head. There's a tune on Jagged Lamb called Live and Learn. And that's just kind of like a standard of mine now. Like I've been playing that song ever since I first wrote it. And people really like it. You know, it's like a favorite song of mine, of certain people. When we cut the track for that, I was just sitting there. It's like 7 minutes long. I kept waiting for Jim to bring in the big beat, and he never did. He just kept tapping on the rims of his drums the whole time.
Okay.
And I thought, you know, it's so nice. It's just got like a sense of intimacy to it this way. So now I didn't tell Jim Keltner what to play. You know, he would sometimes take his cue from my demos because my demos had me playing drums on them.
Okay.
So whatever information he wanted to take from that, he would use it. That was the great part of Jagged Land when we cut those tracks live. It was no editing, no punching. It was all just whatever happened in real time. And then some overdubs, but, you know.
We should talk about then the end of Right on Time, that the reason it is as long as it is you have a complete fade out. The song is done, but then it comes back with both you and, I guess, Greg going crazy. And there's more, you know, fast ride cymbal Keltner action going on here. Yeah, it's another, 25 seconds or something of just, yeah, any thought about it? Like, so I guess that's how you were jamming it. And then the initial thing is like, so you did something in the mixing process just to, you know, reshape it. Oh, we're leaving. Oh, no, now we're back. And then fade again. Do you recall that decision?
All that crazy stuff is from a different take than the one.
Oh, okay.
You know, but I wanted to have that on the record. It's like I loved it when it broke down and Jim just went bananas doing whatever he did. And so we just took that piece of that other take and stuck it on the end of the track, you know.
All right. Well, that makes a lot more sense that the fading out was not just some kind of fake within one take, that you're actually splicing things together. I guess let's get the third song out there. I wanted to go back in time further.
Okay.
Fantastic Planet of Love from Life's Too Short. Actually, kind of a similar feel overall to Right on Time. This sort of do-do-do-do-do. We'll hear the beginning of it to see whether I'm right about that. But very different aesthetic overall. I guess this was not in your minimalist period. It sounds, the vocals, the ahs here are quite in your face. Sounds like a Steely Dan recording.
Mm.
Yeah, any thought about where you're at back in 1991 at this point?
Yeah, I remember writing that one. The idea was, I was thinking of like a Vegas lounge band, trying to think of a song that a Vegas lounge band would have played. Maybe like Louis Prima's band, although it doesn't sound at all like them. But I was just trying to do these sort of chord changes that I thought were like groovy jazz chord changes. And that's all. It was like a pastiche, although I should look that word up before I use it. So I'm using the right word, but it was just this concept, I guess. So I got all the chord changes together and the melody at the same time. That was all like one thing that I wrote in one sitting. I don't remember writing the words, but I got the title. I thought, oh, that's a cool title. The album track, I just started playing that song again recently with the band I have now. We don't really play it the same way. We don't try to play it like the record. I slow it down. I have to slow down a lot of things now because, you know, I want to be able to get the words out without running out of breath and without hurting myself. I'm really concerned with breathing properly, not exerting myself, just going, you know, over the top. You know, if you don't breathe right, you get dizzy, you know, and you can pass out. So, Planet of Love. I, you know, it's just a song of mine that's been around for a while, and it's kind of a novelty. It might have been the first tune I ever put on a record of mine that was in a minor key. I still don't exactly know how that turned out the way it did, how all my songs are in major keys. But Planet of Love is in G minor or something. Now I play it in D minor. It's lower so I can really sing it good.
Let's hear it in full.
Fantastic planet of love.
Oh, that sounds kind of nice.
Yeah. Well, it's very.
I like that.
Do you remember? Yeah, who I didn't write down who the producer was on this or anything. It was this. Very much.
That had a nice feel to it. It was a good tempo. It's Kenny Aronoff on drums, Fernando Sanders on bass. Oh, I worked on a record that he was the producer of. Played on one track on an album by a woman named Susan Werner. I liked him, and he's from Detroit, not from the Detroit area. So next time I did an album, I just asked them to come and play. And that's it. Everything else is me. Like, it's on that track, it's them, you know, drums and bass, and then I did everything else. Ed Stasium is the producer.
Oh, it says he plays some keyboards, so there's got to be keyboards.
Really?
I don't know that I noticed them in this song, but somewhere on the album, at least this is what Wikipedia is telling me.
I don't know what it would have been either. Honestly, I don't. It was like really a long time ago.
Well, so at this point, though, you'd already sort of taken control, right, of your production. And, you know, that when you're doing the early albums, it's maybe more, well, you tell me. The record company is doing a little more in terms of, okay, this is the producer and they're going to make sure that this is radio worthy. And then at some point, I know you sort of went more indie. Was this already past that point that you'd sort of had an increasing level of, oh, I'm going to do a bunch of covers and thing, and now this is sort of the reemergence of your personal vision or something like that? At least that's the way I was reading the progress in the albums through the 80s.
This is from my last major label album.
Hmm.
I did 5 albums for Warner Brothers, right? And that's a whole saga. And then I did one album for a label called MCA Paradox. The Paradox part of it was this guy from New Jersey named Marty Scott, who's I'm still friendly with and is a nice person. He had an album deal for a minute with MCA. They were going to distribute his label, and they were bankrolling him and all that. He signed me, and he signed the Roaches, too. Both of us had recently been on Warner Brothers and weren't anymore. And then the third artist on MCA Paradox was a guy named Richard Barone, who's still a friend of mine. Anyway, it was just a one-shot deal, really. And after that, I was out of the major label world and glad of it. Anyway, always I was really strong-willed and really hands-on as much as I possibly could be with everything. That's with every one of my records, you know, starting with my first album.
Putting a Diane Warren song on the previous record, that's still your call and not the record.
Yeah. Well, see, that was my last album for Warner Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And I just didn't give a shit anymore at all. That album is not a favorite of mine.
Good evening.
Last one I did for Warner Brothers. In fact, there's a guy I know who loves all of my records. And I really appreciate that a whole lot from him. And I like him a whole lot. But I'm not going to lie to him. I tell him, no, I'll never love that album, that Good Evening album. You know, it was a nightmare. This guy bought some tapes on eBay. I don't know. I was trying to figure out who got rid of these tapes. Somebody was cleaning out their garage and they had all these DAT tapes. You know what DAT tapes are?
I have a DAT player right next to me.
Yes. Okay, yeah, this guy that I know, he bought some DAT tapes off of somebody from eBay from the Good Evening album, and he said, "Oh, you know, let me send you these files, and you can listen." Because I said, "I don't listen to that album," and he sent me the files, and I listened to it, and it just made me so sad that I ever made an album that bad. It just broke my heart to hear it, you know. But anyway, the Diane Warren song was, you know, one day. We would just go in and I wouldn't have anything to record because I'd just gotten so sick of the bullshit, you know. I wrote some songs and then I got a funny reaction to them from the label. So I just said, forget it, fuck it, you know. And I started just doing cover tunes to fill the album out. And Kenny Aronoff came in the studio one morning and he goes, oh man, I was with Diane Warren last night and I told her I was working with you. And she says, oh, I got a song for him. Give him this cassette. And so we played it and I just said, oh, great. Yeah, we'll do this one, you know, just because we needed a song to do that day. So we did a Diane Warren song. I'm just like, who cares? But, I, you know, I didn't know anything about Diane Warren. I'd never heard of her. I was dumb of me to not know who she was because she was a huge success even then, you know. And then my A&R person got mad at me. My New York A&R person got mad at me for doing this song. You know, she said, what are you doing this stuff for? And I just said, I don't know. I liked it. You know, I listened to it. I thought we could have some fun with this. Let's, you know, we got to do something. So we'll do this. But anyway, that album, Good Evening, is like, ugh.
All right. So all that was just to say that life's too short. A mere 2 years later, you're switching to MCA.
Yeah.
And you still have a pretty big budget, right? I mean, this seems like,
yeah,
it's a very slick album, but you get to do stuff like Fantastic Planet of Love, which is a terrifically adventurous song. I can't imagine. I don't know. Is that the kind of thing that, like, too many chords? Like, what do you do it? Like, that the label might have objected to?
No, I didn't get any flack from anybody about anything. You know, like, I think one of the guys at the label that was involved with the album was a fellow named Paul Atkinson. I liked Paul. He was at a couple of different labels. There was this one time when I went to this bar with him. It was on the southeast corner of Tompkins Square Park on the Lower East Side in New York City. And I was living a couple blocks from there at the time. And so Paul was at RCA at that time. And he said, you know, if you can get out of your deal with Warner Brothers, I'll sign you right now. I'd already tried to get out of it. I'd tried to get out of it over and over again, but I like begged them to throw me out the door, but they wouldn't do it. I had to make all five albums that were on my contract. So I tried a little bit. It didn't work. But then later on when I was with MCA, Paul was there at the same time. So it's like, oh, now we can work together a little bit. So I remember him coming to the studio one day just to listen to something we were doing. And no, that was pretty good. I was in good spirits for that album, really trying my best.
Well, let me again, just to try to get into the arrangement a little bit, play some of the guitar solo. And in this case, it's the second guitar solo. So I just wrote Psychedelic Guitar Noises. So you'd had an actual solo before that, but now it's just the string scraping, or do you even remember? Yeah, because it's just an interesting structure that we're going to have a guitar solo that's 2 minutes long, really, because you have a solo, then you have that thing, and then you have more solo, mm-hmm. and then it fades sort of in a very gradual way that it makes it just sound like on this planet, you're just soloing forever.
Again, I haven't heard it since it was new, but I found the demo for this song, though. Mm. Recently I did, and I listened to it, and I thought, boy, this is really good. You know, I was kind of like on fire with this song a little bit. I got really inspired by this one. So I'm, you know, whatever's on the album track, there's no other guitar player on this track but me. So I must have done it, whatever it is.
When you do it live, is this end up being a, you know, we can make the end as long as we want kind of song toward the end of the set?
Yeah, it is a little bit that way. There's another guitar player in my band, a guy named Fernando Perdomo. You know, like he's the kind of like the one in the band who likes to stretch out and play a lot of solos. I don't really do that anymore. I kind of lost my taste for doing it myself, but I like to hear somebody else do it if they're into doing it, you know. I don't think I'm a good improviser anymore. I don't feel like I want to be that guy anymore. At my age, I just don't feel like being that guy or trying to be that guy. But Fernando's great. You know, people love to hear him play. And so, you know, I give him some space at the end of that of Planet of Love. I still play some solos in the show. The band that I have right now with him and me, it's a great guitar band. Just the way the two of us play together is really a cool sound. Really, it's a beautiful sound, if you ask me. I really like it. And he's such a great listener and just has, you know, such a way of thinking in detail. So, yeah, we do kind of just like weave this thing together when we play. And it's really great. And the song is slowed down from how it used to be so I can sing it properly, as I explained before. The band I have now is a great band.
Well, I would think slowing it down would let it be a little more sexy, that it's it's kind of this gritty, but if you're just whipping through it, the fact that you have, oh, sugar, like it's clearly, I don't know, there's it's not like the lyrics are explicit or anything like that, but I don't know how it seems like it could be more down and dirty than this version is by slowing it down a little bit.
I guess, yeah, sure, you know,
okay, that's always so that's, the thing. That's not something that has crossed your mind as you're reworking it. I felt like Trouble's Plaything.
That's a pretty good line. Yeah, it's just another song. I have a bunch of songs with, I only have about four topics, but anyway, yeah, this is another one. You know, just the madness of the world is hammering me, and you're the only one who can pull my mind out of this abyss. I write that same song over and over and over again because it's kind of true to life and my real life. You know, my wife, she can really calm my nerves. So yeah, I've got like six or seven songs about a situation like that where, you know, I'm talking about bombarded information overload or emotional overload. And here's this person who can just clear away all the whatever it is.
It's sort of reflected in the structure. You know, the chord progression is so crazy but then it gets down to this fantastic planet, this sort of like Elvis line that, you know, is accessible to everybody. So that, you know, the fact that it's just fundamentally a dance song, do you recall with this sort of string of chords, like how much music theory is going into this, or is this just feeling around with your fingers until you get something? Okay, I know I wanted to descend somehow, and because it seems like there's some augmented and some other things packed in there.
I was just trying not to write anything stupid, you know.
I completely sympathize with it. Not wanting to write, you want to write something accessible and that's fun, but you don't want it to be a cliche. You don't want it to be stupid. So like, well, let's thicken the chords a little. Let's do a little twist here. That I totally hear that in all three of the songs that we picked here.
That's all. I just try to write good stuff.
All right. Well, speaking of that, let's wrap up by introducing the last song. I want it, so we're just going in reverse chronological order, and one of my favorite songs of yours is Our Town from your second album, Field Day. So I just wanted to include that as a thing to say goodbye and let people hear that, and hopefully they'll go off and want to listen to more of your stuff. Do you have some introductory words before we just say goodbye about this song, this era?
Just, I do love this track. You know, I just think it's beautiful. That whole album I love. The songs were kind of written hurriedly, some of them. And I didn't know I could do that either, you know, because the songs on my first album, Our Town is from my second album, right?
Right, yeah.
The songs from my first album had already all been written, you know, like about a year, at least a year prior to when I made the album. But then we're going to go in and do Field Day, and I had to just really come up with a bunch of songs really quickly, but it worked great, you know. And so that was a nice surprise to myself that I could do that. I was new to songwriting, really, when I started making records. So anyway, Our Town is just, you know, I don't want to say too much about it, but I do really love it. I think it's a thing of beauty.
And Steve Lillywhite producing in his heyday, you know, with all these other albums that I love from that era.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. So I really love his records. I mean, Fairy Tale of New York, that's pretty good, don't you think? Steve, I just had an email exchange this morning with Steve, you know, and a really nice one, too. So anyhow, yeah, Our Town, that's a great one.
All right. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me. I hope folks go out and listen to more of this stuff.
Me too. Thank you, Mark.